Good morning, everyone. This is Michael Collins. Is anybody on the line today?
Hi, Michael. Christy's on.
Good morning. Or afternoon, I should say. It's just a little bit after one. All right, well, I at least have one, so I'll take that as a quorum and go ahead and get going. This is the April 21st financial series call, Lunchtime Learning. Today we're going to talk about improving credit scores. So the Lunchtime Learning series, for those who are new to it, is a roughly monthly call that we do to cover some current issues in family financial education. For each call, there is a brief. That brief is located on a website, fyi.uwex.edu/financial-series. And today's topic is strategies for improving credit scores. So that is posted as a PDF file or an Adobe Acrobat file right on that website. In addition, on that website, there are some additional links for other resources that I'll talk briefly about. And in a few days, there will be an audio file of the recording of this call. So I will go through the brief over about the next half an hour or so, and then open the floor for questions, comments, suggestions that people have regarding their topics that they might be interested in. Topic for today is building credit worthiness, and today I'm going to be talking through the brief, which is about 5 pages, called Community-Based Educator's Guide to Building Credit Worthiness. This is a PDF file, which is goes through about 5 different steps that I'll refer to as strategies that you can work with clients. I should say all of this is focused on this general topic of credit worthiness, and I'll sometimes be a little bit loose in terms of what I mean by that. It might mean going from having no credit history at all, so a young person perhaps, or someone who's not had much of a credit record themselves, so somebody who maybe has mostly had their accounts tied up with a parent or with a spouse, something else. It also might mean somebody who has a credit history but a poor one. They've gotten into trouble, not managed their credit well. It might also mean people who have a credit history but just not much experience, haven't paid much attention to their credit, and you know, maybe have a okay credit record, but they'd like it to be better. And so all of those are examples of situations where we might want to have people improve their credit worthiness. And oftentimes I mean credit score, and I'll talk about just doing credit score and a credit report in just a minute, but it's not just credit scores. It's about the items that are in that credit report, in that credit history, and the ways that that information is interpreted by creditors, by employers, by insurance companies, by others who look at that credit history to basically size up what a consumer is like. The credit record is an unusual thing in our marketplace, and I've talked about this on these calls before, but it is privately held information about you, about individuals, and you're only really allowed to look at it under certain situations, and essentially private firms sell, they trade, and pay money to have access to your private information. The information in that report can have pretty profound effects on your ability to get credit or in the judgments that, say, employers might make about you. So it's a strange kind of thing where you have to be responsible for maintaining information in this database, which is something you don't own. And even more, the purveyors of those databases, the credit bureaus and the lenders, creditors, don't really have a strong incentive to make sure the information in that report is accurate. At least they don't have as strong incentive as you do. So it's a strange kind of a creature. And so we've done calls before on the importance of credit reports and maintaining a credit report. And then we do a campaign, the 226-1010 campaign, where on February 2nd, June 6th, and October 10th, we encourage people to pull one of their credit reports. You can pull a credit report from each of the 3 credit bureaus once a year. So those are topics we've talked a bit about. But today I want to talk more about how do you actually deal with the information in those reports in such a way that you optimize what potentially your credit score can be. So the credit score is just a number. It's a calculation based on a formula. The most famous of the credit scores out there is FICO, the Fair Isaacs Company. FICO score. So credit scores can be, you know, in theory, they could be as low as 350 and as high as 850. But for most people, they range from the high 500s, low 600s, into the mid 700s. That tends to be the range that we really think about with credit scores. So it's about a 200-point swing that we see. So there's nobody out there who has a credit score of zero. You know, zero would be something in the low 500s generally. And there's really nobody out there who has a credit score of 100%, which would be in the high 800s. And actually, creditors don't think about a 702 credit score as being that much different from a 700 credit score. What they think about are general categories. So a person with a credit score in the 500s is a much higher credit risk, in fact, exponentially higher credit risk than somebody who has a credit score in the 700s. Somebody in the mid-700s is a little bit less of a credit risk than somebody who's in the low 700s or high 600s. So it tends to be more in gradations as opposed to a numerical value. It's not like a time in a race where, you know, one is definitely better than another. It's more of a way to categorize people. The other thing you have to remember is that credit scores are sort of relative measures. So it's what's your relative risk to the average, and the credit score formula is reconfigured all the time as that average changes. So over the Great Recession, obviously a lot of people have changed their credit habits, and you might think that we might see a grand shift in credit scores. In fact, credit scores have been somewhat stable, and that's because the formula has sort of shifted and changed over time. So, you know, we have to sort of take these numbers for what they are, which is a sort of crude indicator that's used in the credit industry. But there are things you can do that make that credit score change, and so we'll talk a little bit about what strategies you can do to maintain that score or to even build that score in some cases. As you think about the credit score itself, you know, it is all entirely 100% driven by what's in the credit report. And what's in the credit report is a line for each account that you have. So a credit card is one form of a revolving credit line that might be out there. Or a auto loan might be a line that's out there, or a mortgage, or a student loan. Other kinds of debt that might be out there. And so when payments are on time, really all that changes in your credit report is there is a statement of a balance and of that payment being made. When a payment is late, that's recorded. When it's two payments late, it gets recorded as sort of 30 days late for the first payment, and then 60 days late for the second, and then 90 for the third, and so on. And obviously the more behind you are, the more serious that is. A 30-day payment, you know, missed payment here and there isn't nearly as detrimental as a, you know, 90-day payment where you didn't make a payment for a long period of time. The other thing that's in the credit report is any kind of information about the total amount of credit taken out. So if you started out with a mortgage of $100,000 and you paid off $50,000, then it reports both the original and the current amount owed. Same with credit cards. So if you have a $14,000 available balance, and you've spent 12, then that's reported. And so these are all measures that are used in determining credit worthiness. The other major factors in the report are, in addition to payments and amounts owed and amounts available, are public records. So these are judgments, garnishments, things that have gone to collections, where courts have intervened to set up payment terms. These are obviously much more extreme cases. Not very often do people have these, but they last on the report, like most things on the report, for a long time. Most items in the credit report will last between 5 and 10 years, and some of these more serious things, like a garnishment, a collection, a bankruptcy, a foreclosure, can be on the report for 7 years or even longer, depending on how they're treated by creditors over time. So these things really do have a prolonged effect, more than just a 30-day missed payment, say, a year ago. The thing you got to remember about a credit report is that the items in the credit report are like, I've heard a couple of different analogies. So one is like a school transcript. So you think about your transcripts for college, for 4 years in college, and your freshman year, you get a D in one class and a C in another. By your senior year, you're getting all A's, and you look like a great student. But on average, you're still digging out of that hole from those D's and F's your freshman year. Or likewise, if you think about it like more like a driving record. So you have a pristine driving record, and then you have to get a few tickets. Those tickets linger, and they make you look like a riskier driver until they finally go fall off over time. So a credit report is something like those kinds of documents where information accumulates over time. It becomes less deleterious over time, but you still have to sort of recover. Even if you're a great driver today, those old problems will pester you. Even if you're a great student today, those old poor grades will still matter. It gets less and less over time, so it's not a forever commitment to a particular credit score that you have. But it does require you to think about how you're going to deal with strategies when you've had problems in the past. I'm going to talk about both credit building and credit rebuilding. So credit building, typically we think about credit building as somebody who has no credit record or a very thin credit record. So you sometimes hear about this called a thin file client. Thin file meaning they don't have many items in their file. It's not very fat. They have a couple of accounts. Maybe they're accounts that weren't in their name. Maybe they're accounts that they had for a short period of time. Those clients don't even have enough information to get a credit score. So if I were to pull a sample of particularly lower-income, younger consumers and ask, say, 1,000 of them to show me their credit report, maybe only about 800 would have enough of a credit history to even have a credit report. So they would go to the Android Credit Report website and not be able to find their credit report because they just don't have anything there. And then of those 800 who do have something there, maybe only, 600 or 700 would actually have a credit score because the rest wouldn't have enough files in their credit report that they would actually get a credit score. So, you know, there's a good portion of people out there who have thin files or no files and for whom a credit score isn't even possible. It's not a bad thing necessarily. They just don't have any credit history. And so it makes it hard for a creditor to judge them. And so many people would like to have a scorable credit file, and they want to have more activity in the credit report. So we call this credit building. And I'll talk about a few strategies in that area. The other area is credit repair. Now, credit repair is oftentimes much more complicated because you're talking about getting a report that exists but has negative items in it and try to make it better. This is harder. Sometimes it involves legal issues. Sometimes it involves credit counseling. And it can take a while, particularly if you have a, serious problem, 90-day delinquencies or deep problems to try to fix. So I'll talk about these sort of interchangeably, and if you are confused about whether I'm talking about credit repair or credit building at any one point in time, let me know. But in general, just think about credit building as taking people with thin or no file and getting them to the point where they can get a score. And think about repair as taking people who have negative histories and trying to make that history better with current activities. All right, so in terms of strategies, the first strategy, step one, as you can imagine from hearing me talk in the past about the importance of the 2266-1010 campaign and about checking your credit report in a regular way, we actually have a website devoted just to this topic called fyiuwex.edu/creditreport. The most important thing that we can encourage people to do is check their credit report. You can get it free once a year. I don't think most people need to pull it more than once a year. If you try to pull it more than once a year, you're going to get charged for it. So the key is to try to time out your pulling your report from each of the three major bureaus in such a way, roughly every 4 months, that you get a snapshot of your credit report overall, and you check with each bureau every year. And that's what that cycle of the February, June, and October checks can do for people. Now, it should be noted that the credit bureaus, when you log into the website and ask for your credit report, they know the last time you looked at that bureau website. And so if you try to pull that report 364 days instead of 365 days apart, they will call you on it. So these dates, while they're arbitrary, you have to maintain that rhythm in order to not get yourself in a position where they say, oh, sorry, you can't pull it, or we're going to charge you money if you report, but in 3 days you can get it for free. So the timing of it actually does matter a little bit. For clients to get their credit report, they can go to the annualcreditreport.com website, or they can mail in a paper form, which I know some of you work with clients who don't have internet capability or who just prefer to do the paper form. Both work, and they work fine. It's obviously slower when you mail away for the report, as opposed to instantaneous online. But either way, they're going to need to know they're going to have their full name and their social security number, their birth date, addresses, and this can be one that trips people up where they have lived other addresses that have been on record and they don't have those full details available, and then when they try to get their report, they get rejected out and they have to go pick up the phone or they have to send it in paper because they didn't get the information right. The other is that it's helpful to know what accounts you have open, because some of the identity questioning, the reports are set up so that they don't just want anybody to pull your credit report. They're trying to make sure it's you. So they ask you questions about your accounts. Well, some of us don't remember every detail of our accounts of how much, you know, this report or that report, this account or that account might have as a monthly payment or as a balance. So having those handy is also an important strategy too. So again, we have a whole website devoted to pulling their credit report and how to look at it. I think the thing I want to focus more on here is, so if you're interested in credit building or credit repair, what do you do with that report? And the key thing is to look at what's in the report and to look at the lines and start to categorize them. So the first thing to look for is just how many accounts are there? How many of those are installment loans? So an installment loan is an auto loan or a student loan. You can think about these as any loan where the amount of the payment is fixed every month. We're paying $200 a month for 60 months or whatever that term is. That's different from revolving loans. So most reports have both kinds, both installment loans and revolving loans. Revolving loans are loans where the amount might vary based on the credit usage that month. So a credit card is the most typical. A line of credit for people who have those might be another. You know, we want to look at both how much is owed on each of these accounts and then how much the sort of initial balance was and how much the available balance is, at least for the revolving debt, for the credit cards in particular. So it's just counting the number of accounts, looking at the balances. I mean, that's the first major task. If there's only two or three accounts and those balances are low, then this is, you know, this might be a thin file. We don't know what the magic number is that gets a credit report to be scorable. But typically three accounts is, you know, the minimum. It's hard to get a credit score unless you have a very long credit history on those three accounts, two or three accounts. When you see an account that only has one, a three report that has one account, it's only a few years old, that would be one that would be very challenging to have a credit report result in a credit score. The next thing you do after you look at the number of accounts and the amount of balances and the amount of available balance is to look at the payment history. So the main thing we care about isn't actually whether you paid on time, but whether there's any history of late payments. And then of those late payments are recent or if they're old, if they're modest or they're severe. So modest means you missed, you know, one payment by 30 days. Severe means 60, 90 or more days. So an occasional 30-day late here and there isn't the end of the world. It will hurt the credit score, but not dramatically. One or two 60-day lates is much more severe, and even 190 can really reduce credit score. So we're going to look for those patterns. Obviously, not missing is good. And a recent record for the last 2 years of no misses is a very positive thing for a credit report. In fact, people can come from a pattern of occasional misses or even a serious delinquency here and there. After 2 years of paying everything on time, keeping credit balances sort of in check, really seeing their credit score go up pretty dramatically. So there isn't an exact formula to know, you know, when is too much or how much you can get away with. But even somebody who's had some problems in the past, if they have a couple of years of good payment record, are going to see their scores go up in a measurable way. Again, this is mainly this task, this first step is just sort of seeing where you're at, checking accounts, seeing where they're at. One of the things you're going to see on a report, particularly for somebody who's got a longer credit record, is old accounts that are still there, accounts that are paid off. Those are actually good. And so, you know, you want to make sure that what's there is accurate and then think about moving on to the next step, step two, which is fixing any errors if you find one. Most reports don't have errors. The estimates I've seen are somewhere between 5 and 10% of reports have some kind of error in them. Errors oftentimes aren't about the accounts, but about the information about the person, say your name is wrong, or addresses are wrong, those kinds of things. Or maybe you've got some accounts on your account, or in your report that are actually accounts that belong to someone else. So it does take some time to go through and make sure that everything there is really you, and particularly if you say you have a sibling with a very similar first and last name, and those are the cases where things might get confused a little bit. The bigger issue is when there's really an error about account histories. And this is where you really want to think about filing a dispute. So if a creditor said you were late, but you weren't really late, or if a balance was paid off, but they aren't giving credit for getting it paid off, these are things that you want to definitely fix. The problem with this process of fixing things is it's not as simple as picking up the phone and asking for a fix. You want to document everything in writing. Oftentimes it requires providing time for response. So the credit bureaus have up to a month to respond, in some cases even longer, to anything that you say needs to be fixed before they do anything. This can be frustrating for consumers because they're not getting much information while information about them is out there that might be wrong, that might be hurting them. And so it's important for people to really document what they're doing. And in some cases, they can be sending letters to their creditors. Maybe they worked with the credit bureau while simultaneously also mailing or emailing or calling the creditor that made the error and see if they can fix that on their end as well. But this can take time. It's not unusual for it to take 3 to 6 months for errors to be fully fixed. And then you have to make sure that fix is actually done for all three bureaus. So checking and making sure that what was fixed for Experian also gets fixed for Equifax and TransUnion, for example. One thing that I will say that people sometimes miscode as an error is if they had a card that was lost, say you had a credit card with, Visa, you lost your Visa card, so you called the provider and you said, hey, I lost my card. They're going to basically cancel that card and issue a new card. It's really still the same account. All your balances transferred, your history and everything about transfers. But now on your credit report, it might look like, depending on how it was set up, it might look like you now have two accounts. This can actually be in your favor if it's a good account. But sitting here and there, the thing is it'll confuse some people. They may say I only have one credit card, but it shows two. Well, that's because you lost your card at one point. So that second account is really just the same account repeated twice. All right, so moving on from the fixing errors, we'll go to step three, which is, okay, what can you do behaviorally to try to make your report look better and ultimately your score? The biggest thing, as I said before, is just hang on time. So if you do some of these other strategies I talked about, but continue to pay your bills late, it's not going to matter. So the most important thing is paying on time, coming up with a spending plan, having some strategies to keep fixed and variable costs at bay so that you can keep up with your bill payment is number one. So there's lots of ways that people do this, and it's really all up to the individual what works for them. So some people do fine with envelopes and calendars as a way to remember to pay on time. Others set up text messages or email reminders or ask a friend to phone them, whatever it takes. To try to make sure they pay on time and don't forget. It's easy to get distracted and not forget. Setting a certain day of the month is a strategy we often talk about. There are probably other ways too. One strategy is to set up an automatic payment. I mean, many of us might actually do that where we pay our bills automatically so we don't have to think about them. But if you have audiences you're working with who keep lower balances in their accounts just because they have high expenses and low income, the automatic payment strategy can backfire in that the automatic payment will try to go through even if they don't have the funds available. So it is important to sort of gauge or calibrate how much you recommend things like automatic payments depending on the population you're working with. Alright, so assuming everything's being paid on time, the next step is to think about paying down balances. And there is no one right or wrong way to do this. There's lots of, if you look around at various books that are out there on credit repair and building a credit, they'll give you different kinds of advice. So one is to pick the smallest account and pay that one off first. Another is to find the account with the highest interest rate and pay that one off first. Another is to take how much you think you can spend on repaying debt and divide it across the different accounts that are out there. You know, frankly, all of those are good. It really is a matter of where people are at. Some of them are simpler to do than others. And for a lot of people, the best strategy is sometimes to just focus. Just focus on paying something to getting that overall rate of borrowing down. And oftentimes the place to focus is on revolving debt and specifically credit cards. If a credit card has a available balance of $5,000 and the borrower has $4,000 out on that card, they only have $1,000 of available credit, that looks risky from a creditor's standpoint. That makes that borrower not look like they have liquidity. It makes them look like maybe they're pushing their resource limits. Getting that down, getting that $4,000 balance down to $2,000 or $1,000 is probably a main priority. The utilization ratio overall that seems to be, so if you add up all the account, all the revolving account balances and all the available credit on a revolving account, and just an average utilization ratio, you'd want it to be below 30%, and most of the stuff I've read suggests even below 10%. So if you have $10,000 in available credit, you'd only want to be carrying $1,000 in any given period. This is just revolving debt, though. So for installment loans, the most important thing is that you're just paying down debt on a regular interval. So you're paying whatever the minimum is. You know, if you're prepaying, that'll be reflected in the report, but it's not as important as keeping that available credit versus that extended balance on a revolving debt in a manageable level. 10% is obviously very aggressive on revolving debt, and so for a lot of people, it's going to be challenging to keep their ratios that low. But that's sort of a goal to be shooting for. One of the things to look at is if you pull your own credit report, let's say you're somebody who is extremely attentive to paying your bills on time. So you always pay your credit card balance off every month. You never carry it from month to month. But if you pull your credit report, it might say, even though you have a $10,000 available balance, you've used $3,000. And you say, wait a second, no, I pay that every month. Well, the thing is that every month, your statement comes, and as of that statement date, you had a balance because you hadn't yet paid your bill. And so the credit card company doesn't know when you're going to pay that bill, even though you pay it every month the same date. They can't predict that you're going to do that next month. And so that's credit reported to the credit bureau that way. There's an easy way to prevent this, which is you make your payment before the statement date. Any payments that you make over the course of the month on your revolving debt on your credit card will be reflected in that balance. So you can charge $1,000 and then, you know, a week before the statement date, pay off $1,000, and then you have a balance of zero or close to zero, depending on how much else you've used the card. So this isn't a strategy that a lot of people engage in because you get the statement, it has a due date. Sometimes it even has the extended grace period, which a due date can, you know, you can send in your payment and not charge any interest. But from a credit report standpoint, the statement balance is the amount that you borrowed. Whether or not you're charged interest on it or not isn't of a concern to the credit bureau. What they're concerned about is how much you've borrowed. So some people do make multiple payments over the course of the month on their credit card, and they might do that in part because it makes their ratios look better and therefore makes their credit score look better. And again, this is something that could be done with reminders, with emails, just like the, you know, paying on time strategy could be. You know, one thing I will hear people say is, well, if my point is to get a bigger ratio, why don't I just borrow more? I'll take out more credit cards with a higher balance, and therefore my balance will get down to 10% because now instead of a $10,000 total available balance, I have $40,000 in available balance. Well, true, you did get your numbers down, but creditors see that, and they see you out there aggressively looking for credit, running up the potential to borrow a bunch of money, and that makes them nervous too. So it's really not a good strategy to just open up new cards and try to drive that balance in another spell. You know, sometimes I hear people say that they want to, focus on their smaller accounts so that they can pay off a card and close it out. I'm always leery about that kind of strategy. It's always a good idea to pay off smaller cards just because it's the more payments you have to make every month, the more likely it is that you might forget one. But paying off a small card, particularly one you can pay off in 2 or 3 months, is a good idea. But closing the card probably isn't, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But if you've got a good credit history on a card, even if you're not actively using it, probably paying it off is a good idea, but not just like closing the card down. For somebody who's really struggling at being able to catch up on their account, credit counseling is an option. I know many the educators in Extension in Wisconsin have worked with credit counseling agencies in their communities. There are a variety of credit repair kinds of agencies out there. The true nonprofit National Foundation for Consumer Credit, or NFCC, organizations are all listed on a website called debtadvice.org. These are true nonprofits. They don't make any money off of, which path you choose to try to catch up on your debt. They are really not there to sell services, but rather to provide advice. There are credit repair organizations that look like they're nonprofits, but are actually selling something. So in some cases they might be selling access to another credit report. They might be buying access to legal services, which may or may not actually help. So it is important to be a good consumer when looking for those kinds of support. I should say that getting help, whether it's from a credit counseling agency or a attorney or anything else, is not reflected in the credit report. So it doesn't hurt anybody to do these things in terms of credit score. And it might help if the advice that they get is good. Some of the other things to think about is, are there cases where it might actually be good to close accounts? Because I said before, generally closing accounts doesn't make a lot of sense. But if somebody has a lot of accounts, say 10 or more active credit cards, and a credit report that goes on for pages and pages, and they have cards that they, particularly the worst offender here are like store cards. So you go to the Gap, or you go to the Walmart or somewhere, and they offer you a credit card, and you take it. And so you have all these cards that are on your credit report, but you never use. Sometimes people do want to close those just because they have too many cards. They're afraid of losing track of them. The older accounts that are in good standing probably aren't ones to close, but the newer accounts where you just really never really use them very much and they're just kind of a nuisance, it is okay to talk about closing down some of those. Again, I wouldn't do it for somebody with a thin file, but somebody who has a bunch of cards and really it's beyond the level that's easy to attract, to sort of keep track of, closing those accounts is probably a good idea. Now, the other problem, go ahead.
This is Kristen Eat, and I'm struggling with the way to rephrase this question, but it's along the lines of, what if you are in the 60, 70, and 80-year-old group? Do the same kind of things apply, that thin credit history, eliminating cards? Does it make a difference at different ages? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so the big question for anybody in those ages is if they're really active in the credit markets anymore.
Credit score may
not matter.
They may need it to rent a car when they travel, or they may need, a credit kind of thing. So,
yeah. These kinds of things I'm talking about aren't really going to affect their score enough that it probably matters. They have such a long credit history that closing some accounts aren't going to make a big difference.
But does a long credit history stay with you?
It does, yeah. Yeah.
Because we've got folks in our area now that are selling their homes and moving into retirement centers, and they need to have verification, and they look at credit scores, and just wondering how that affects them.
Yeah, it's very, very, very rare to see an older person who's successfully managed a mortgage and other debt to have a low credit score. I mean, they're usually going to have average or better than average credit scores. So closing accounts for them probably isn't going to make a big difference. And because they're not too concerned about the cost of credit, you know, even if their points, their credit scores went down 20 or 30 points, it's not going to be that big a deal. And frankly, as people get older, the chances of things like identity theft, of losing cards, of losing track of cards, of being charged fees and not seeing it gets higher and higher. So simplification, is an important strategy in the 70s particularly. Even if that means the credit report, you know, looks worse than it did when it was in the 60s.
Okay, that's good to know because we get those questions occasionally.
Yeah. I mean, the most problematic consumer is somebody who's, you know, younger or has had real credit problems and they want to, in the future, borrow to buy a car or borrow to buy a house and they just can't because their credit report is so poor. Usually people who sort of at the other end of the life cycle are, you know, maybe they're borrowing for a car, but it's much less frequent.
So do creditors look at age?
They don't. So the age is in the credit report. They know your year of birth in the credit report. They are not permitted to use gender or age or other factors in the score itself. But they do look at the age of the account. So obviously, an account with a long history of regular and distinct payments is going to look better. So it's not a years old age necessarily, but it is a years active in the credit market with good standing.
Okay, thanks.
So talking more about the paying off account balances. So again, this is one of the cases where you're going to have to balance with clients whether it's a more of a priority to close down accounts or not close down accounts. And again, if you're going to close down accounts, you're going to focus on only people who have a lot of accounts and a lot of little sort of nuisance accounts, and that may be a place where you're going to worry about that. But otherwise, the other problem we have is people who have, say, an account that they took out 10 years ago, say it's a credit card account, but they don't use it very much. And so that may not actually be reported as an active account. Even though you own the card, you don't get statements, you don't use it, so, you know, you sort of forget that you have it. Well, the credit bureaus sort of forget you have it too. It's there, but it's not shown as being an active account. So if you have an account that you've had for 10 years or more, and you've been always on time in your payment, one strategy is to occasionally use it. Use that credit card to pay a semi-annual insurance bill or something else so that, you know, every once in a while it is active, and that, you know, that history then counts towards you of sort of being an active, account with a good, strong history. Likewise, if you have an account that you've had problems with in the past, even if you close it, it's still on your report, but you might want to not as actively engage in that account as often. So sort of being strategic about account usage is another way to encourage those good accounts to linger on the report. I should say, too, that some people get worried that if they carry any balance from month to month, that'll hurt them. It rarely does. As long as you're paying on time, and your ratios, your utilization ratios are in the ranges I talked about, carrying a revolving balance on a credit card from month to month really doesn't have a big effect. Again, as long as you pay within the grace periods, the minimum payment, carrying a balance isn't in and of itself a risk factor that's sort of taken into account by the credit score formula. The last thing I'll say about paying off balances is that sometimes it does make sense to go right to the creditor and say, you know, we had a problem in the past. I had a crisis. I lost my job. I had a health issue. I got divorced. You know, something major happened. I'm still with you. I have been paying on time for the last year or 2 years. I'm a good customer. Can't we do something about that problem? Can we make that problem go away from my credit report? And lenders have the ability to do these sort of they call them goodwill adjustments or re-aging an account so that they can basically make a delinquency go away. Now, should you do this frequently? No. Should you rely on the lender actually doing this? No. It's an exception to a rule. But sometimes it works, particularly if you're a good customer with just one episode where you can, you know, clearly say this was a problem. Can't we try to work around it? Let me say one last thing about somebody who's opening an account. So let's say you are looking for a car loan, or you really do need a credit card. If you're shopping around and applying for loans, any inquiry within a set period for the same kind of credit, so if you're shopping for an auto loan and you apply for four different auto loans, that doesn't count as four auto loan applications. It counts as one, as long as they're within about a 30-day period, 30 to 45-day period. So, you know, we should not tell people not to shop around because it's somehow going to hurt their credit report. If you're asking for credit every month, that's going to hurt your credit record. It's going to hurt your credit history. It's going to make you look riskier in terms of your FICO score. But shopping in one particular point in time intensively for one particular form of credit is not necessarily a bad thing. And we think if you end up picking a lower interest rate, then that's probably a very good thing, at least in terms of your overall financial situation. All right, so next thing I want to talk about is building up new accounts. So this is most important for people with a thin file who don't have much credit history. It can also be important for somebody who has a sort of rough but thinner file. So they have had a few accounts and they didn't manage them well. So either can benefit from a credit builder strategy. Two different kinds of credit builder strategies that I'm familiar with, and you may know some others. One is a credit builder loan. This is where a bank or a credit union will essentially give you the opportunity to borrow and put money into a savings account, which you get when the loan is repaid. So you're essentially borrowing from yourself to repay yourself. But what they will do is report every one of those payments to repay that loan to the credit history, to the credit bureau, so that it then contributes to the credit score. So there's an example of Park City Credit Union in northern Wisconsin that has these accounts where you borrow at least $500, they put it in a savings account, and then as you make the loan payments, you're paying off that loan. And then eventually they release the funds and you can have access to your savings, which you just borrowed to save, which is sort of a mind-bending kind of track here. But the most important thing is they're reporting all those payments for that small loan to the credit bureau. A similar strategy is a secured credit card, where you put money down, say $500 or $1,000, and then you take out a credit card to borrow against that amount. If you default, they keep your money. But any payments that you make towards repaying that credit card are reported to the credit bureaus, and assuming they're all on time, it will help you build a credit report. So these are two strategies that we've seen. Both are very, very legal, very credible. They are oftentimes a way for people who've had trouble in the past to start to get back on track, and they're also a way for people who don't have much of a history to establish one.
Michael?
Yes.
What kind of interest rates do they charge on those loans?
The secured credit cards tend to be pretty typical credit card rates, in the teens. Typically.
But the bank loans that you were talking about.
I don't know what Park City is charging on theirs. There's a link in the brief if you want to check it out. It's not a particularly high risk loan for them, so I tend to think they are charging sort of an intermediate rate just to cover their costs.
Okay.
So another strategy that you'll sometimes see is where people will piggyback their credit report with somebody else. So the most common is a parent and child. So I can add an authorized user to my credit card, our revolving credit account, so that an authorized user now can use my credit history, and that then shines a good light on their credit history. Essentially, I'm loaning part of my credit history to them. Of course, I'm also counting on them to repay the loan. So it's not a strategy to go into lightly. There are actually organizations out there who will, believe it or not, sell the opportunity to buy into somebody else's credit report, but never actually give you access to the credit. So in other words, they will find somebody with a good credit history, ask them to make you an authorized user on their account, but they never give you the account number. In fact, you never know who the person is. And so it's a sort of artificial way to build up a credit report. It is currently legal, although certainly being seen with much skepticism by the regulators, as you can imagine. But it is it is a very legal and legitimate strategy for, you know, somebody you know and trust, and particularly, as I said, in the case of a parent and a child, to try to build up a little bit of a credit history that way. One last thing to think about is there's lots of stuff that shows that you're a good credit risk that doesn't show up in your credit report. Utility payments, telephone payments, rent payments. These are all things that might show up on the credit bureau if you don't pay on time. So it would show up as a collection or as a judgment. But it doesn't show up if you're sort of a good citizen and pay everything on time. And so there are some new services that are out there that are allowing people to get credit for making these other kinds of bills on time. So these are sort of like alternative credit bureaus. This is a very emerging market. I can't say there's any standard out there. There are very few lenders who say, oh, I only use this particular bureau for these alternative credit histories. Some creditors will just take your word for it. If you show them a history of receipts of paying rent on time or a utility statement that shows that you've paid on time, some lenders will actually treat that as an item that helps build out a credit report that maybe was too thin or maybe you had some trouble in it in the past. But there isn't really a great systematic way to do this other than talking to your lender, showing the evidence that you've been paying on time. And then in some cases, it might make sense for somebody, say, who's got a very thin file and interested in doing something really big, like investing in a small business, to help build up an alternative history. And so for this, the main system that we have out there is the basically it's you pay your, make your payments to a third party, and then they make your payments for you. So this is a challenging way to start to build up credit, but it's not an alternative that's out there. All right, so I'll stop there and see if people have other questions, and then we can wrap up. Anybody there?
We're here, just no questions.
Okay. I'll just say a couple of closing things. I mean, one thing we want to avoid is telling people that they should be shooting for a perfect score. There's very little value to having a perfect score. We really just want people to recognize the fact that they have to maintain their credit, that their credit history matters, that it matters in both the cost and their ability to access credit, but also in their ability to access other things like insurance and employment. Landlords will check them, those kinds of things. And most of the learners we have out there haven't been schooled in this. It's not sort of, it's been a relatively new development that people have to sort of maintain their credit portfolio like they do their investment or savings portfolio. So it's not as much as we're trying to say, well, you know, everybody should go out there and have a perfect credit score of 800 or something like that. Much like if we were teaching nutrition, we shouldn't say everybody should only consume 1,000 calories or everybody should have a body mass index of 25 or something else. You know, we sort of let people be where they're at, but don't let anybody get by without paying attention and sort of just neglecting their credit history, because creditworthiness is just too important for too many aspects of family finances today.
Michael, is there additional information out there more targeted on how employers are using credit scores to evaluate potential employees or applications that they receive? And similarly, any other research about the targeted use that insurers are using credit? I mean, I understand that they're using it, but in terms of, is it a score? What scores affect the pricing on insurance and things of that sort?
So a couple things. There is a report that I can post that talks about how employers have used credit reports. Typically what we've seen for the employer use has been for people who are involved in an accounting or a financial services functioning or something like that where they worry about your financial condition. So that's sort of where we first started to see it. But now for some companies, it's just sort of a standard procedure, just like they do the LexisNexis background check. They pull their credit report, and some of the companies have packaged these into an employee screening tool. So You know, typically it's only a factor that might result in you not receiving a position if you're involved with money and it has some real negatives in it. But I can try to find that report and get that posted on the website. In terms of insurance, so insurance is funny. So there are actually insurance risk scores, and so there are scoring systems. And they actually use a whole different system for claim history. So there's a system called Clue where any claim history, not only on you, but on your property. So your house might have a history of claims, you know, even though you didn't live in it, that they can use for pricing insurance. The main thing they use the credit score, the FICO score, or the credit report for, is to figure out if you're actually going to pay your premiums on time, and to assess your riskiness from that aspect. It's probably more likely to be used in things like auto insurance than homeowner insurance, for example, where, you know, auto insurance, they don't have much information about the property, and so they judge you based on your age and your gender and what kind of car you're driving. And so this is an additional factor there. I haven't seen the reports on that recently. There was a flurry of them probably 10 years ago, but I'll see if I can find something recent and also post that to the website.
That'd be great. The reason I ask is because both are questions that come up frequently when I provide education on credit, and particularly since we've been engaged in the 2266-1010 Check Your Credit Report campaign, I've had some folks call about the use of credit with insurers. So specifically, I had someone that was, you know, in their later 60s, maybe early 70s. I don't recall them giving me their exact age, but they were wild about the fact that they were being charged a higher premium because they didn't have much of a credit score. So they basically paid everything off and were more operating as cash is king. They really hadn't been using credit in some time. And so just, yeah, any resources to help respond to those type of questions or to point them to additional information, I guess, would be helpful.
Yeah, I'll see what I can find, particularly on that insurance front, because that is a relatively new phenomenon that seems to be out there. Other questions? I'm glad to hear there's a lot of interest in this topic. It's obviously an important one. Anybody who's involved with the family financial team, this whole topic of creditworthiness really is one of our main themes for this 2-year period. So, you know, we're seeing this theme percolate across all kinds of topics. And it's not just about, obviously, getting a loan. It's about the whole process of managing the report and how to think about that. So I will end by talking about our very next call, which is May 19th, so just about a month from now. And this is our sort of end of the, at least academic year, and what we typically do, or at least what we did last year, is we heard from folks about books and family financial topics that they were interested in. So if anybody has seen any books, read any books, or even just come across books that they haven't read but would like to get some reviews of, let me know. I like to hear from each of the educators out there about books they've been interested in, so I'll probably be recruiting some of you to chime in on various books and topics that you've heard of that are of interest. So thank you all, and for team members, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Take care, everybody. Have a great week.